And by doing that, I'd like to introduce our host, Mr. Doug Gray. He's had 30 years of leadership in several sectors, and he's an independent director and vice chair of Marshall Street Capital, having retired as its president. He's a former managing director and advisory director at Morgan Stanley. Doug is a former and now life trustee of Northwestern University, and he's been there for over 30 years. He's still a current member of the Northwestern Medicine, Finance, Investment Committees of the Board. He's the past chair of the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago, which is now called the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab. He's past chairman of the McCobb Medical Center, and he's been there for 15 years, which is an umbrella organization that coordinated activities among all five of the Northwestern affiliate hospitals. He's former lead director and now life director for the Northwestern Faculty Practice Plan and former executive committee member and now life trustee of Northwestern Memorial Corp and Northwestern Memorial Hospital, among the many other things Doug has done. He has an economics degree from Miami of Ohio and attended the Chicago Graduate School of Business. He's married to Marion Cameron Gray, who is here with us today, and he has two adult children. Please welcome Doug Gray.
Thank you, Susan, and good afternoon, everyone. Before I introduce our speaker today, Dr. Doug Vaughn, on the subject of longevity and aging, a topic of some potential theoretical interest to a few of us, I would like to make a few acknowledgments. First, very best wishes to our student guests here with us today. You are our future, so please keep plugging. Second, I would like to introduce Nora, Doug's partner. Nora, stand up, would you please? Welcome to Naples. Second, I would like to acknowledge two leaders of the forum, Kimberly Query, who was my co-sponsor for Doug's presence here today and who is not here. She and her late husband, Lou Simpson, have been major benefactors to Northwestern's Feinberg School of Medicine and Northwestern's Graduate Life Sciences Departments. And Ed Liddy, the forum president-elect, who was chair of Northwestern Memorial Corp and Hospital a few years ago. And Dr. Doug Vaughn is the chair of Northwestern's Department of Medicine, the largest department in the Feinberg School of Medicine and a top 15 medical school in the country. Among other things, Northwestern is noted for its interdisciplinary research and learning. The Department of Medicine encompasses 11 specialty departments, including cardiology, which is Doug's specialty, endocrinology, oncology, infectious disease, immunology, geriatric medicine, among others. In the aggregate, the Department of Medicine is responsible for hundreds of millions of dollars of research annually across these specialties and hundreds of researchers and separately hundreds of clinical doctors. He oversees 120 residents and 110 fellows across the many subspecialties. Incidentally, early in COVID, Doug and I were playing golf, was the first doctor to signal to me the unknown and risky mutation potential of COVID-like viruses, which sadly came to pass. In addition, a few years ago, we agreed to take on the leadership of the PhotoSNAC Longevity Institute at Northwestern, and there's some brochures that may be available as you leave today if you're interested. Now one of the world's foremost institutes of its kind. Its mission is to understand how aging works with the purpose of expanding the health span of all people through future therapies and lifestyle interventions, enabled in part by the interdisciplinary research under Doug's purview. For example, he led the discovery of the first genetic variation that appears to protect against biological aging in humans by studying old order Amish near Bern, Indiana. Doug grew up in a small West Texas town near Amarillo. That's cattle country to me. For those who don't know where Amarillo is, it's halfway between Dumas and Tulia. He attended Oklahoma University rather than Texas. That I didn't understand. Attended University of Texas Southwest Medical School, home to several Nobel Prize winners, and did his residency there. Doug then moved to Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital to complete his research and clinical training, culminating in his first teaching post at Harvard Medical School. He was recruited to Northwestern Medical School as chair of medicine from his post as Vanderbilt's chair of the cardiovascular medicine division, a top-ranked U.S. cardiology department, where he was considered one of the country's top 10 cardiologists. He would want me to emphasize that he was mentored throughout his career by some of the world's most notable cardiologists along the way and is indebted to them. Doug, welcome. We look forward to your thoughts, and we'll entertain questions after his talk.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. I didn't think anybody in the world knew where Dumas and Tullia were, but, you know, you've got some stories to tell. Thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you, Susan, for hosting me as well. Sorry Kimberly can't be here today, but I appreciate her inviting me several months ago. Really enjoyed hearing from the students. You know, that was fantastic. You're in a fantastic place in life. You know, the key thing in the world is, you know, find something that captures your imagination. Sounds like many of you have. I've never heard the words engineering and passion in the same sentence before. Good for you. Good for you, though. That's the way it works. I had a good news, bad news joke to start with, but having the students here kind of changed my perspective on it. But I'll go ahead. Anyway, if you've been around Chicago lately, or maybe other places in the country, you'll occasionally see a billboard. The billboard says the first person that will live to be 150 has already been born. And that was the good news I was going to tell you today. And the bad news that went with that was saying, I don't think anybody in the room is going to be that person. especially my fellow diner, Eric, here. But with the students here, maybe we do have that person. Maybe one of them, maybe one of you will live to be 150. And that's kind of that really is a good intro to the story I want to talk about today, a story about aging, a story about longevity. You may not believe it, but the curtain is being pulled back in real time about what drives aging. And I tell my students, I tell my residents, say that the two big things that are going to happen in medicine over the next 30 years are we're going to figure out how to prevent and cure and treat a lot of different cancers. Something happens every week in that space, but we're also going to figure something out about aging. And you, I tell them, you are going to be giving therapies to people that are going to slow the aging process or even reverse it. And I think that is inevitable. So a lot to think about, a lot to talk about, but it's a very, very exciting time if you're a human being. You're going to get to be the beneficiaries of all that. So I'm a cardiologist. I oversee a big clinical department. And we have all kinds of patients that are hospitalized on our services every day at Northwestern. But almost every disease that we see in patients that we take care of, the most important risk factor for those diseases is age. Age is the most important risk factor for heart disease. It's not smoking. It's not cholesterol. It's age. Age is the most important risk factor for cancer. Age is the most important risk factor for diabetes. Age is the most important risk factor for Alzheimer's disease and dementia. So it goes on and on and on. There's something, hey, what's the surprise? There's something bad about aging, right? You know, something happens. We lose our resilience. We lose our ability to repair ourselves. We lose our ability to regenerate cells and to get through times of stress. And to get through times of challenges to our body. So the reality is that we're starting to figure out that there are components of aging that drive each of those disease processes, and that's what we're really thinking about and talking about a lot as part of this process. The one of the points that's already been brought up today is that, and I think you can look around the room and you can realize that there is a big people age at different rates, right? You know people that are older than you that look fantastic, and their biological age appears to be younger. In converse, there are people that you know that appear to be older than their stated age, right? It's not, the two don't always overlap. The two don't always correlate. And it's really not so many times you orbit the sun in your life. It's really what happens with regard to your biology. So that difference between biological aging and chronological aging is a key component of the challenge and the questions that we think about today. We have ways of measuring biological age. And it's getting more sophisticated, more refined, and more precise, almost on a weekly basis. There are all kinds of things that we can measure in any of you that tell us something about your biological age. There are simple things, like physiological changes, or changes in your strength. Simply, your grip strength is one of the things that deteriorates as we age. But there are all kinds of things that change how fast you walk, how fast you think. Your heart rate variability changes as we age. You know, when we're young and healthy and you're a distance runner or a swimmer, you have tremendous opportunity or swings in your heart rate from slow to fast. That tends to get compressed as we age. Your heart rate variability is reduced in total scale, and that's one of the things that we can measure in people. There are other things that change as we age. There are a group in Brazil just a few months ago did a study they published in Nature Medicine where they examined 2 million electrocardiograms from normal people and ran them through a machine learning program and artificial intelligence. And now they can take an electrocardiogram and this program can look at it and it can tell you your cardiac age and if you're going to have an event within 7 years very, very accurately. It's unbelievable. I mean, I'm a cardiologist. I can't see these changes. They're things that the human eye doesn't pick up. But these kind of processes, these kind of measures are becoming routine. There are other factors that change that really track with your biological age. The one I'm most fascinated right now about is one that involves epigenetics. That's a word that may be a little bit unfamiliar to you. It turns out as we age, our DNA and all of our cells gets chemically changed a little bit. It's not being mutated, it's being methylated. Side groups are being attached to your DNA in a variety of different places. And some of that change is driven by our diet and your exercise and all kinds of things. A group at UCLA has been studying this in detail now for over a decade, and they've come up with algorithms that look at the pattern of methylation of DNA across your genome. They have a little bit of a twisted sense of humor about it. They call it grim age for some reason. But it will tell you what day you're going to die and what you're going to die of. It's unbelievable. I mean, it impacts on every disease you can think of. And, you know, that sends a little shudder through the audience. But there's a good side to that story because methylation doesn't have to be fixed. It's malleable. And already there are studies coming out that you can shift the curve or shift your methylation pattern just by diet and intensive exercise. And there will probably be drugs to do that in the years to come. And that's part of the excitement of this, that some of these processes that drive aging-related diseases are likely to be malleable and something that we can impact upon therapeutically. So we see a lot of problems in medicine all the time. I see patients all the time that age rapidly. Some of the common problems that we see that drive aging are things like chronic kidney disease. For example, if you take a 25-year-old on dialysis, that person has the same risk for cardiovascular disease as a 75-year-old person. And really, we don't have much that we can do to prevent cardiovascular disease in people that are on dialysis. People with chronic HIV infections age rapidly. It used to be a lethal disease, now it's not, but there's something that happens to them because of that persistent viremia that impacts upon aging in a variety of different systems. We see aging in many other circumstances. We even have patients that get admitted to us that have genetic problems that drive accelerated aging. They have short telomere syndromes or other kinds of problems that cause accelerated aging. And we have a few that come into the hospital relatively regularly. They're about your age, but they look like they're 80. You know, it's amazing. Amen. So again, it tells you that actually the biology here can be addressed, and it's visible. It's visible to all of us. I want to spend a few minutes telling you a fun little story about our own work and some perspective that I have on aging because of this very kind of unique experience I've had over the last few years working with an older Amish community in northeastern Indiana. This is a group that immigrated to around Bern, Indiana, from Switzerland in the early part of the 1800s. Doug mentioned it when he was introducing me. Now, I've been to Bern, Switzerland, and I've been to Bern, Indiana, and they do not look alike. I'd rather go to the former than the latter, but, you know. There is a Swiss clock tower in the middle of town, you know. So this community is geographically and genetically constrained or separated from the rest of the world. They're old order. They live an 18th century lifestyle. You know, they get around by horse and buggy. No electricity. No combustion engines. They speak a low German dialect with each other. And, you know, their lifestyle hasn't changed very much in the last few years. In a long time. Last centuries, really. So this particular community was identified in the early 1990s as harboring a novel genetic mutation. A mutation in the gene that codes for a protein that I've been working on my whole career. The protein is called, I'll just say it's called PI-1, plasminogen activator inhibitor type 1. You don't need to remember that. PI-1, but PI-1 it controls your clot dissolving system in your body, and that's why I got interested in it as a cardiologist. Now, over time, it's become clear that PI-1 is one of the markers of aging of cells and tissues. And that was discovered maybe 20 years ago. And then I have a laboratory where we do experiments with mouse models of disease, including animals that have mutations in PI-1 that we've engineered. And we've learned over time that these mice that have a genetic deficiency of PI-1 are protected from aging in a variety of different ways. They're protected from aging-like pathologies. And so my focus, driven by what I learned from those experimental models, drove me to think about what can we find in this Amish community? My hypothesis was that the carriers of this genetic variant might be protected from aging. Now, it's interesting. They're a founder community. Every single one of the people that carry this genetic mutation can trace their ancestry back to a single individual who married into the community in the late 1800s. Now, they have big families. This one individual had 17 children, two wives, and 142 grandchildren. All right, so you fast forward six generations, you can figure out there are about 2,500 carriers of this genetic variant in that community out of there are 20,000 members of the community in and around Bern, Indiana. So every one of those carriers are at least related at some level, because they all can trace back to that one individual. So in late 2015, we went over and started asking questions and measuring things in the community. We measured a lot of different things that reflect aging, kind of the things I talked about a few minutes ago. But we measured it in people that carried this genetic variant, and they didn't know it. And we measured it in people that didn't have the genetic variant, their cousins, their neighbors, their friends, their relatives that didn't have it. And so we had a nice control group. Mother Nature is doing the most remarkable natural experiment in Adams County, Indiana. These people get randomized at birth to a genetic with a genetic variant that they're not even aware of for their whole life. And then somebody like me comes along 50 years later and I start asking questions. You know, but we did things like measure their blood pressure, measure their fasting insulin level, check them for diabetes, all kinds of things. And it turns out in every system we looked at, the carriers of that genetic variant are protected from aging in every single way. Now we're expanding that now. We're bringing more technology into our exercises there. We're trying to measure other systems that we didn't measure before. But I'd be very shocked to learn that this isn't true across all the different systems, that this one little gene, this one little protein, and carrying half the normal amount is enough to protect you from aging in a variety of different ways. The carriers don't get diabetes. They have lower fasting insulin levels. They have lower blood pressure. They have longer telomeres. Oh, and they actually live about 10 years longer than their unaffected kindred. So it's a remarkable story. I feel privileged to actually have the opportunity to work with them and get to know them in the community. There's nothing like it in the world. This genetic variant that they have has really not been discovered in any other humans. It's only in this one place. It's almost like a Darwinian exercise there, actually. I believe it. I think those people that carry that genetic mutation have an evolutionary advantage compared to the rest of us. So one last thing I wanted to mention in my formal comments is related to our new Longevity Institute at Northwestern, the Potisnack Longevity Institute. John Potisnack and his family generously endowed the institute just late last year. We're just getting it started. It's a multidisciplinary institute, has a lot of different centers. We're going to do all kinds of science around aging, from epidemiology to the very basic science to nanotechnology and aging. The one component of it that I'm most excited about, and I think the one that'll most interest you, is the human longevity laboratory that we're establishing. So what we'll do there is we can bring any of you in, and we can put you through a few tests to tell you your biological age. And it includes everything from checking your hearing to checking your vasodilator capacity, checking your blood pressure, checking your pulmonary function tests, even checking your cognitive function, and measuring your epigenetics and things like that. So we'll be up and running with that relatively soon. What we want to build is the biggest database in the world about human aging, and actually track people over time, bring them back in at regular intervals, repeat the studies, refine what we do because we're still learning about it, and then hopefully we'll start doing interventional trials in the not-too-distant future where we get people to enroll in a study where they might take a medicine that theoretically might have an impact on aging, or they might do intermittent fasting, or they might do something else. I don't know. There are lots of things there's so many questions that we could ask. The list is incredibly long already, but we will be one of the places in the world that really helps define what aging is about in human beings and how we can slow that process down a little bit and make it possible for people to have a longer health span. We're not there to make everybody live to be 150, but we want you to live healthy and enjoy life for as long as you can, and we want to push back the onset of disease, and that's really the goal of the Institute. Thank you a lot for your attention. No questions?
We've got a... One more question. So let's see if we can, why don't we ask several questions? First of all, what would you suggest would be the things people in this room and more broadly can do to extend their longevity in aging?
The one intervention that's been proven to work in every animal species known is caloric restriction. Okay? You know, that's bad news. It does work, and it even works in primates. But the work that's been done in primates, our cousins, monkeys, it makes them live longer, but they get very grumpy. So just be aware. I think that's kind of true in humans too. So, you know, maybe we'll come up with something else.
Yeah. Doug, you mentioned intermittent fasting.
Yeah.
And how does it work? And what's its efficacy?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a nice corollary interrogative related to the question we just had. So. It turns out that at least in experimental models, it's looking like intermittent fasting is just as good as caloric restriction. So keeping the plate away from you for 20 hours a day, at least in mice, it works very, very well. They can have as many calories as they want during the period of which they get to eat, but they're restricted the rest of the time. So I think there's room for optimism there that, you know, you can restrict your eating to a limited time of day and probably gain much of the metabolic and molecular benefits that you would get from the rigors of caloric restriction.
Is that every day or once a month?
Every day, except Saturdays.
Well, we're going to get back to more technical questions, but I had the most interesting. There is one. Really interesting question that I just can't resist asking.
Okay.
It's from left field, but it's a good question. Do you think that Supreme Court justices should be tested for mental aging? I just couldn't resist that one.
You know, that's a pretty broad question. I mean, I think we want to elect people that we have confidence in their cognitive processing in general, right? So, Supreme Court justice or anything else.
You finessed that one really well, Dr. Yeah. Dunn. Okay, how important is genetics in biological aging?
Well, genetics are the foundation of everything that happens to all of us. It sort of sets the framework for how you respond to stresses and challenges in life, whether they're immunological stresses or inflammatory stresses or metabolic stresses. So, yeah, no doubt about it. You know, it's important to choose your parents carefully. You know, if your parents all made it to 90 or 100, you're in pretty good shape, but that's not the only thing. I mean, there is some luck involved in living a long time. You know, you don't know if you're going to have a car accident or something else is going to happen. So there are other factors involved. But even our Amish friends, you know, with the first clearly defined genetic variant that protects against aging, it only gives them about 10 more years than their unaffected kindred, which is probably the most you could ever expect from a single gene variant in a human being. But, you know, you get all kinds of genes from your parents. They're going to impact upon all kinds of systems. And the aggregate of that is what contributes to your health span and your lifespan.
So, Doug, there's several questions around what lifestyle, psychological, physical activities would you recommend to people who are aging and want to preserve their efficacy?
Yeah.
For long.
Yeah. That's a good question. I mean, it's even been more poignant in the last couple of years, in the middle of the pandemic, and as we've dealt with the challenges related to COVID, and you know, and actually there's another example of age being a risk factor. And our patients at Northwestern, age was the most important determinant of a bad outcome. I would encourage you again to go back to those fundamentals. Regular exercise, good diet, round of golf pretty frequently. You know? It's not too complicated.
Okay. Now, there's a question here. I'm going to ask the question differently than this was framed, but dementia, Alzheimer's, are there drugs and that are able to either prohibit or protect or delay for Alzheimer's and or dementia, and what are they?
Well, there's the only drug that's been approved so far is this new monoclonal antibody by Pfizer that snuck through FDA approval somehow. It's got marginal benefit, I would say, at best, and it's very, very expensive. So the CMS is reviewing whether or not it'll actually pay for it. But, you know, there's an unbelievable amount of intense effort to figure this out. And I don't doubt that we'll have drugs that impact upon that or slow it down or reverse it in the not-too-distant future. But it's been an incredible challenge. And, you know, there are thousands of people working on this in pharma and in academia. And it's been the Everest of biological science. It's really, really hard to change that. You know, in Alzheimer's has been prevented and cured in mice hundreds of times, you know, but it's just not the same. It's just not the same in humans. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. So, Doug, getting back to the Amish people in Bern, you've identified, I guess you've identified it, but is there any way that gene can be reproduced and or transferred, and where does that process stand?
Yeah, actually, that's part of the good news of the story today. We already have a pill that we can give to you that will lower your PAI-1 level. We've been working with a small Japanese biotech company that invented these molecules 15 years ago. They're already in clinical trials in Japan in phase 3. They're not going after aging. They're going after other aging-related illnesses. We actually have an IND from the FDA, and we're giving it to patients with COVID-19 at Northwestern. We're the only place in the country in North America doing that. So you don't have to have gene therapy. You don't have to have a gene deleted. I can just have you take a pill, and it'll lower your PAI-1 level in your blood. And we see rather remarkable effects in preventing things like emphysema and cardiovascular disease and even Alzheimer's if we give these drugs to mice. So I'm very optimistic that is replicates the benefit of the genetic deficiency that we see in the Amish. So there will be a drug like that in the marketplace in the not too distant future. And I don't have any equity or anything like that, so I'm not trying to sell it.
Kimberly May.
Yeah, she might. Yeah.
And but so once it gets FDA approval and it's available in the open marketplace, is this the type of drug that everyone would take on a regular basis?
Well, you could. I mean, the FDA is going to be very particular about how this gets approved. It's not going to approve a drug for aging. I don't even know how the FDA would even go about that process. I mean, you're talking about having to give a drug to people for decades to see an effect on longevity and lifespan. But I think there will be selected targets of aging-related diseases. It might be lung disease. It might be metabolic disease. It might be cardiovascular disease. There will be indications that will be built around a drug or drugs like this that will eventually be used. And theoretically, it could be taken for a long time. The nice thing about, the Amish thing was peculiar. How did that get discovered in the first place? You know, if these people are completely normal, how did they know? Well, there are a few individuals, only 10 in this whole community, they have a double hit. They're homozygous. They have two of the genetic mutations, all right? So they have two copies. They got one from mom and one from dad. And the homozygotes, we call, have a bleeding problem. Their clot-dissolving system works too well. So a little girl showed up to a clinic when she was 9, and she wasn't hemophiliac. She didn't bleed spontaneously. But after she'd been injured, if she had some minor surgery, a day or two later, she would start oozing at that site, because her clot-dissolving system worked too well. And that's what that PAI-1 does. It blocks your clot-dissolving system. So it turned out she had a brother with the same problem, a couple cousins with the same problem, and they, you know, they, they're, they're, that can be recognized. But the carriers, this is the fun part, is the carriers don't ever bleed. They don't have this bleeding problem at all. They've got no downside that we can tell, and they're certainly unaware of it, unless we genotype them and tell them. They would never know. And then they go on and they are protected from all kinds of disease or morbidity.
Doug, just talking about that a little bit more. So there are 2,500 people that have this gene.
Probably.
That's in both Switzerland and Indiana, or no, just in Indiana.
We don't know anything about Switzerland. We don't know where the certainly that could have been a new mutation in the one individual that everybody can trace their cells back. It's a dinucleotide insert. So two bases were inserted into his PI1 gene. It generated, follow this, Doug. It generated a premature stop codon down the street a little bit, and so they don't generate a protein with that one allele. So I'm interested. I'd like to go spend some time in Bern, Switzerland, and see if there are carriers around there. I don't know. But the thing about the Amish is they're very constrained in terms of their community. They keep to themselves, so genetically, if so to speak, you know.
So okay, just shifting gears sort of on a more global basis, my experience, and Ed's, I'm sure, as laymen, know that there's a lot of global research practices that are going on all around the world, just in medicine, it's in life sciences and everything. With some of the difficulties with China and with some of the polarization that's going on geopolitically, how do you see research being either impaired or enhanced with this sort of shift in geopolitics? And, for example, the lack of communication between the Chinese docs and life scientists and American. I'm just curious as to how you see this whole research. Because, frankly, from my perspective, this global collaboration has created wonders for the world.
Yeah, the scale and the scope of the growth of science in China over the last 20 years is breathtaking. You know, they have laboratories in Shanghai and other places with more sequencing capacity than the whole U.S. combined, you know. And so they've got an enormous potential and opportunity to discover things. But we still have the best scientific establishment in the world, particularly in biomedical science. I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. The creativity, the innovation, the track record that we have still exists. But, I think we'd be better off in the world if we could collaborate on these things because, you know, aging affects everybody, whether you're in Naples, Florida or Beijing. If we partner, then I think we can make things happen quickly.
But have the recent politics muted a lot of this collaboration?
Well, it's certainly dried. You know, a lot of our postdocs, a lot of our junior scientists over the last several years, and you come walk around the labs at Northwestern, are people from China. You know, they've sent an enormous number of people over here to train and to learn, and many of them go back. And now it's harder for them to get in. It's harder for them to get visas to stay. And so it is impacting on things, and it will impact on our own productivity because we don't have that pipeline of people. Now, some of the students today might end up doing something, but that's just a few. You know, we're talking about thousands and thousands of people.
Yep. Thank you. That's great. Shifting gears again, what tests would you recommend to predict future medical conditions?
If I had one test, I'd get my grim age measured, that epigenetic measure of DNA methylation that Steve Horvath and his group developed at UCLA. Methylation, the pattern of methylation in DNA not only predicts you, they've tested it out on 149 different species, everything from mice to whales, and it predicts lifespan in every single species. I mean, I think he found a fundamental truth. I guess he'll get a Nobel Prize. He's unbelievable, and the rapidity with which they refined and advanced the precision of that measurement is amazing. And now, you know, you can get it done for, I don't know, $200. It's not very much.
And you don't need a prescription or?
Nope. No.
Would you recommend everybody do it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, unless you... You may see things you don't want to know. I don't know.
Well, this brings up another dimension. That's true. Another dimension of aging. So what are some of the ethical considerations to living to 150? I'm sure you've thought about those a lot in your spare time.
Yeah. Well, that's a fundamental part of the equation. That's a fundamental part of the question. It's something we're already talking about in our institute, and actually we're gonna have community leaders involved. We're gonna have national and international leaders come and talk to us regularly to talk about the societal impacts of lengthening the lifespan of people. What's that mean? How does that work? How do we make that fair? How do we keep that fair? I mean, I'm really, I hope that we come up with things that can apply to everybody, that everybody can benefit from it, that it won't be just for people that have the means to do something, but it's a really important question, and I don't have all the answers there. How do you ever build a pension that lasts up to 150? You know, you'd be on the street.
Now, this next question is sort of a practical question, and if you don't get it right, we'll give you another chance at answering it. How does alcohol consumption affect longevity?
I encourage it in moderation. I think in general there's pretty good evidence from epidemiology and public health studies a little bit of alcohol is good for your cardiovascular system and other systems too. But everything in moderation, Doug.
Yeah, well, we'll suspend that for the next one. So, Doug, would you talk a little bit? You have a lot of subspecialties under your purview.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about how you integrate those in the service of this Longevity Institute?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, we not only have all these divisions involved from our people in that are kidney specialists to our people, our pulmonary specialists. You know, we have one of our pulmonary group has one of the biggest programs in the country on aging in the lung. They're figuring out what that looks like. And so groups like that are already involved. We also include all the other departments that are around Northwestern neurology, even obstetrics and gynecology. They're very interested in aging. Aging impacts upon their reproductive capacity of women and different ways than men. I think everybody knows that. They also talk about kids aging, and the aging process starts the day you're born, amazingly. And the environment that an embryo or the baby sees while inside its mother impacts upon its epigenetics for life. Hard to believe. Not changing the DNA, but changing the methylation. And it impacts on, for example, women with gestational diabetes or diabetes with pregnancy, if you look at their children a few years later, they have a methylation setup that seems to predict the early onset of cardiovascular disease.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about various aspects of aging. The one thing we haven't touched on a little bit is the whole psychology around mindset. Mm. Do you have any observations or any dimensions in your research so far around the attitudes, mindsets, or influences that can affect aging?
Well, there's nothing wrong with some healthy optimism about life and some appreciation for how lucky we are every day to live where we are and at this point in history. You know, it's that's a subjective sort of impression, but people with a more positive attitude and outlook seem like they preserve some of their youthfulness in a variety of different ways. And I think there are ways that stress impacts upon the environment that we feel internally that I wouldn't be surprised someday we can actually see the biochemical mark of that kind of stress in the epigenome or in other things that we measure. So, I think it does pay dividends to have a good attitude.
So if you could identify anxiety or stress an inordinate amount of it, theoretically, then you could come up with protocols that would deal with it. That would be, that part of the research you might do?
You mean beyond gummies and things like
that? Or smoking a cigarette, so you have,
Yeah, I think so, absolutely.
Yeah. I know the term CRISPR technology.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about what CRISPR technology influence or role might have in what you're doing?
This is a fun story. So CRISPR is this genetic engineering technology that was discovered by Jennifer Doudna and a few years ago. She got the Nobel Prize. Basically, it allows you to go in and very specifically edit a gene. And we use it in mice and in other species quite readily. So, for example, we used CRISPR to specifically engineer mice to have exactly the same gene mutation that our Amish friends have, exactly the same. Now, they don't wear the clothes or anything like that. But they and now we could say, okay, we can do a short-term study in a mouse, and we can say, okay, these mice are protected, or this is what happens, and then we can go back and measure it in the humans. Or we could find something in the humans, and we can go back and test it in the mouse. That sort of technology, it used to take months and $1 million to make a genetically modified mouse. Now, you know, at Northwestern and other places, you know, you can do it in a few weeks and for a few $1,000s. So it's really democratized the genetic analysis of disease.
That's great. Well, Doug, I think we're just about exhausted most of the questions. We just wanted to present you with a book on Naples.
Oh, beautiful.
And we very much appreciate your being with us today.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
I can tell you he practices what he preaches. Just touch his biceps there. Anyway, we are adjourned. We'll see you all in 3 weeks. All right.